Welcome to Cannabis House Call. This podcast is committed to educating the discerning public and will make the case for cannabis as medicine. Your hosts, Dr. Les Matthews and Dr. Hal Altman, are physicians with advanced degrees in medical cannabis. The Cannabis House Call is sponsored by Compassionate Certification Centers, or CCC. CCC is a physician-owned and leading medical marijuana certification center that helps patients receive legal access to medical marijuana in Pennsylvania. Having certified more than 100,000 patients across the state through its in-office and virtual telehealth appointments, CCC makes the process of getting a Pennsylvania medical marijuana card fast and easy. Learn more at cccregister.com.
Hello and welcome back to Cannabis House Call. My name is Dr. Les Matthews, and I am joined on this podcast by my colleague, Dr. Hal Altman. We are both physicians with advanced degrees in medical cannabis and joined together to produce this podcast on a weekly basis with the sole intention of providing objective and unbiased information regarding medical cannabis to the general population. We have been honored to again be joined by Dr. Andrew Koop. Dr. Koop is a renowned expert and researcher in the field of medical cannabis, one of our very esteemed professors in our cannabis master's program at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. When Dr. Koop joined us on our last podcast, we had an in-depth discussion regarding THC and the contrast with CBD. Today, we want to take quite a different approach. In May of this year, there was an article published in the editorial section of the Wall Street Journal in which another prominent and well-known cannabis researcher, Dr. Bertha Madras, was interviewed by a member of the Wall Street Journal editorial staff to discuss cannabis. And I think it's fair to say that the tone and the theme of that article was in general very negative and derogatory towards the benefits of cannabis relative to the risk. We do not come here today to fight a battle over this, but we do think that there's an opportunity to provide a more balanced discussion and critique of this article. So we've asked Dr. Koop to help us tackle that goal. So Hal, I'll turn it over to you to begin this conversation regarding Dr. Madras's writing in the Wall Street Journal.
My pleasure. Dr. Koop has worn many, many hats at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy, but to our interest today, he's the Associate Dean of Academic Affairs at the university and has been actively involved in the design and presentation of all the science-based curriculum for the Masters of Medical Cannabis Science and Therapeutics program there. He served as an expert on cannabis in testimony before Congress and has become an advocacy voice for medical cannabis. Again, welcome, Dr. Koop. We are absolutely thrilled to have you.
I am thrilled to be here. Thank you, Hal and Les.
So referencing the article that Les mentioned earlier, Dr. Madras, who is an esteemed member of the Harvard Medical School and the Department of Psychiatry at the Mass General, was interviewed, and she was pretty harsh about the potential for cannabis as being legitimate medicine, presented some real safety concerns, as well as making a comment that she really didn't see medical cannabis having much usefulness other than the treatment of specific chronic neuropathic pain. Certainly, what we've learned in the master's course is different than that. And I wonder if you could spend some time maybe telling us your opinion on cannabis from a safety standpoint and then its potential application for cannabis as medicine.
Thank you, Hal. Yes, now, Dr. Madras, her article was a very nice article. She is not wrong in many of the things she says. One of the things that Dr. Madras talks about is the paucity of clinical trials for the use of cannabis as a medicine for a range of different conditions. Within there is said that the reasons for this is that cannabis is currently a Schedule 1 substance. And it is true, I used to have a Schedule 1 license. I bought THC back in the day. A lot of paperwork, as she says. But even with the paperwork, I was not allowed to use it on humans. I could not do clinical trials. Now, there are some universities you can do clinical trials with Schedule 1 substances, such as across the street from us here in Baltimore, Hopkins, doing a lot of clinical trials on Schedule 1 substances. But it's extremely difficult to get those clinical trials approved. So we have the lack of clinical trials is being used as an argument to prevent the rescheduling to Schedule 3 so that we can do the clinical trials, so that we can actually show by placebo-controlled clinical trials that the benefits, scope, limitations of cannabis. So opening to Schedule 3 really does allow the clinical trials. One of the things that Dr. Madras talks about is the high potential for abuse of cannabis. Now, THC can cause dependence. Then so can coffee, so can nicotine. And she does compare with alcohol within the story. But moving to Schedule 3 is the same as moving Tylenol with codeine, which is currently in Schedule 3. So moving to this schedule allows the development of these clinical trials. Part of the issue here at Maryland is that even if I had the licenses, legal here at the University of Maryland does not want us to promote research with humans in cannabis. The Attorney General of Maryland has said this because of the current Schedule 1 license. The other thing, and this really gets into Dr. Madras's argument, is that with the current scheduling of cannabis and the current status of cannabis, what we are lacking is standardization. We do need the controlled clinical trials, but we need it on material that is consistent. If the material is not consistent, it's then impossible to compare one trial to another. So my approach would be, we need to look at the concerns that Dr. Madras raised, but we can't do that unless our hands are untied to allow us to do these controlled clinical trials on consistent material.
And so that would need to be part of the, after cannabis hopefully is rescheduled, that would need to be part of what the producers would do for us. So standardize, we've talked before, there are over 500 potentially active compounds in the plant. We concentrate on THC, CBD, and the terpenes. From a medical standpoint, we'd need to come up with, I don't know how many, 5, 10 different chemovars that could be used to try to establish efficacy and whatever the problem was that we were studying.
It is exactly the same as how the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, has a cigarette. And it's a standardized cigarette so that research can be done, because tobacco is a natural product as well, highly manufactured, but it is a natural product as well. And this is why there was the standardized cigarette developed by the NIH so that the studies could be done. It's the same thing with cannabis. There's going to need to be standardization with standardized cannabis, different levels of the components, CBD, THC, terpenes, and the minor cannabinoids to ensure that one study can be compared to another.
And again, not nitpicking with the article, with Dr. Madras's opinions in the article, but one of the things that she cites is the highly addictive potential for recreational cannabis, numbers that are much, much greater than what we learned. And specifically, she uses about 30% as the potential for addiction or substance use disorder. Is that consistent with what you've seen in the literature?
It really depends how she is defining this. Anyone who takes THC, as you talked about with the endocannabinoid system, when you take any drug, and I mean any drug, your body adapts. Your body adapts. So that if you discontinue that drug, your body is adapted to having that drug present. Suddenly it's not present. Your body has issues because it needs to adapt back to not having that drug present. That is dependence. The level, though, of dependence for most medications is minimal. Folks that heavily use THC in cannabis, the dependence can get high, but it's usually, I wouldn't say 30%, but it's usually minimal in terms of recreational users. However, I really want to focus on the medicinal users. I'm not saying there'll be no dependence, there will, but it's nowhere near the same level as, say, opioids, which is what is implied in the article, that it's similar to opioids, and it's nowhere near the same level. The withdrawal effects is nowhere near the same effects as with opioids.
I think that's really important to point out. Both the opioids and the alcohol dependencies create much greater problems in terms of withdrawal symptoms. The other medical problem that she alludes to in the article is the teratogenic effects of THC on pregnant women. And so for our audience, the effects that a developing fetus might have based upon heavy use of THC or cannabis. And she suggests that there's a higher incidence of prematurity, and there's a higher incidence of low birth weight babies and small head circumference babies, and some fairly significant problems that really echo what we know about fetal alcohol syndrome. I've not seen that in print before. And then as a follow-up to those teratogenic effects, when these kids get to be adolescents, she suggests that they have greater behavioral problems, attention deficit disorder problems, obsessive compulsive disorders, and so forth. Are you aware of any other literature that would support that claim? Those claims, I should say.
The difficulty here is that most of the literature that I have read does not imply that. However, the difficulty is when looking at a person who takes cannabis while pregnant, you need to also take into account other drug use. A person doesn't exist in isolation, whether they smoke, whether they drink alcohol. As with everything else, we really need to move cannabis out of Schedule 1 so we can do these studies. Now, doing studies on fetus, on the unborn child, are extremely hard to do. Extremely hard to do. So this is where we really do need to look at all the variables, whether any other things like poor nutrition, other parts could build into this and follow the children for many years to check. Is going to be an extremely difficult study to follow. And in fact, these studies are still being done with other drugs of abuse, such as opioid, cocaine, methamphetamine. These studies are still being done. We are behind on cannabis, but I have not heard from what I, in my readings, I have not seen those effects due to cannabis. No.
And the final point is in the article, there is a concentration on presenting medical cannabis as pretty much ineffective as medicine. except for one isolated condition, and that's chronic neuropathic pain. In 2017, there was a report from the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine that looked at the evidence for cannabis as medicine, and they certainly expanded on that single use that's mentioned in the article. That included treatment for chronic pain, not necessarily neuropathic chronic pain, but chronic pain in adults. The spasticity and pain that's associated with MS, and the nausea and vomiting that are involved in patients who take chemotherapeutic agents. So certainly those three conditions have been recognized by a fairly august group that it's good for medicine. And again, I think to your earlier point, we are struggling now because we can't do the randomized clinical trials that establish cannabis as medicine for any of the other conditions like post-traumatic stress syndrome and anxiety and sleep disorders, a whole host of things that are waiting to be studied.
I agree with you 100%. I would add, though, the FDA has approved cannabis-derived products for epilepsy, CBD, Epidiolex for epilepsy. I would also add that there is significant evidence to show that a range of mental health problems, whether it be depression, PTSD, etc., are helped through the use of cannabis. We need those controlled clinical trials, both with THC and obviously with epilepsy, with just CBD. We need these clinical trials to be able to definitively say which concentrations, which strain, how much of the cannabinoids is appropriate for treating these conditions, and to show unambiguously the benefits, but also the risks. We need to show these through these clinical trials. Dr. Madras brings up concerns. Yes, the amount of THC within cannabis has been increasing. She is right. It has really gone up. And that is really focused on the recreational market. That's why we need to look at the medical cannabis and really look at the cannabis products that have less THC in them, because then they will be useful. As with anything else, if you take too much of something, everything's got a therapeutic window. So we need to look at what are the amounts of cannabis and not get defocused on the products that are basically being designed for the recreational market with sky-high levels of THC. We want to know what are the appropriate levels of THC for the medical market.
Well said.
And Dr. Koop, just to clarify, the current status of cannabis as a Schedule I drug makes research on human subjects difficult and in some cases essentially impossible, correct?
Correct. Very, very difficult.
A move or change to Schedule III would dramatically change that dynamic. Am I also correct?
Yes.
Okay.
It would still, don't get me wrong, it won't be a free-for-all. It will not be a free-for-all. But moving to Schedule III moves it away from that Schedule I. Schedule I is high potential for abuse, no approved medical use. Schedule II is high potential for abuse, some medical use. So Schedule II are things like cocaine, amphetamines. Schedule III and Schedule II, things like morphine, things like this. Schedule III is things like Tylenol and codeine. So that brings it down to a level that the licenses and the potential concerns of doing research with Schedule III products is nowhere near as the concern with using Schedule I products.
Well, Dr. Koop, we really appreciate you weighing in on this. What Les and I have tried to do from the beginning and will continue to do is to contrast our suggestions concerning cannabis as medicine versus the recreational use. And unfortunately, as we all read particularly in the lay press, about claims that sometimes are outside of our experience, I think we have to take a good look to see whether or not we're talking about recreational or whether we're talking about medicinal cannabis. And I think you've done a nice job of presenting that today. We hope to get you back sometime. We've heard you talk about synthetic cannabinoids and some of the dangers of those for the public. And we'd love to have you talk about that and maybe also talk about what's going on at the University of Maryland. I understand that there may be consideration of psychedelic medicine advanced degree at some point. So we'd like to have you come back for those.
And I agree, Hal. And if I came over today as saying that cannabis is not as nightmarish as what was in that article, you have me on for the synthetics such as spice and K2 and things, I will come the other side and I will tell you that those things can be lethal. So I will be looking at it from the completely other side. So just letting you know.
We look forward to that, always.
Thank you, Dr. Koop.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hal, and thanks to our listeners for joining us, and we'll see you next week on Cannabis House Call. All information, material, and content on this podcast is for general information and educational purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for professional and/or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment by a qualified physician or healthcare provider. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and any materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. Cannabis House Call does not offer personal health or medical advice. If you have a medical emergency, call your doctor or call 911 immediately.